Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Live from the green space today. And when we're in the green space, you can watch the Brian Lehrer Show as well as listen, because we stream live video when we're in the green space. It's equipped for that. So if you want to tune us in, video as well as audio-wise, you can go to our Facebook page. That's one place where we stream it. That's the WNYC Facebook page. Or you can go to WNYC.org, the station's website, or you can even go to the Green Space's own website, the Green Space, and green has an E at the end of it, thegreenspace.org, any of those three places if you want to stream live video of our show for the next hour or so. I want to mention one thing before we get to our next guest. I got a note about two of the audience members in the green space today from someone we know. This says, two of my friends, and possibly some of the biggest fans of the show out there, got married this weekend. I found out yesterday morning that they'll be seeing the show in the green space as their honeymoon. And this says, I'd love to be able to do something special for them, even if it's just giving them a shout out. So Matt and Allison, are you actually here? Are Matt and Allison here? Hey, congratulations. What, you can't afford a real honeymoon? You know, you could go, I mean, it's not the most romantic thing in the world, right?
You could go. You know, one thing at a time.
You could go to the Caribbean, or after that newscast, you could go to Atlantic City. You can sports gamble now.
We like to start slow.
I don't know if the show's going to get you in the mood. So, congratulations, and thank you so much for coming to our show. We're absolutely thrilled that you wanted to be here at this special moment. With me now in the green space, Jeff Weaver, Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign manager and still senior political advisor. Weaver's new book describes their work together since Sanders was mayor of Burlington, Vermont, runs through the presidential campaign, and looks ahead to the future of the Democratic Party and progressive politics generally. The book is called How Bernie Won. Jeff Weaver, welcome to WNYC.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You do know that Bernie lost, right?
Okay, well, you know, it depends what the measure of winning or losing is. If you're talking about winning the nomination, yes, in fact, we did come up short of the nomination. However, if you look at the campaign, which started at 3% in the polls and ultimately resulted in him winning 23 contests and 43% of the Democratic primary vote, you know, the issues that he was talking about at the beginning of the campaign, $15 minimum wage, Medicare for all, free tuition at public colleges and universities, you know, significant criminal justice reform. You know, these are issues now that are in the mainstream of Democratic Party politics. And if you look at a number of the leading candidates for president or talked about candidates for president in 2020, they have all moved to adopt those positions. Most of them are enshrined in the Democratic Party platform. And so, you know, I think, in fact, that Bernie Sanders has done an amazing job at moving the conversation away from the right-wing shift that we have had in this country to open up a whole new way of looking at problems and how we solve them.
I think we have at least one good example of that here in New York. Governor Cuomo pushed through a free public college program in New York State. It's not exactly the Bernie model, but it's free public college tuition, or the last pieces of that tuition,
right,
for people who can't, who demonstrate that they can't afford it another way, for many CUNY and SUNY students. And I think, to credit Bernie Sanders, is fair.
And Governor Cuomo had Bernie Sanders at the announcement of that program, as
That's
a matter
right.
of fact.
I forgot that.
And, you know, let's, you know, I'll give credit all the way around where it's due. You know, in the book, we talk about how, as the campaign, the primary campaign, came to a close, there was a meeting with Bernie and Secretary Clinton in a Hilton hotel in Washington, D.C., where they talked about coming together around some progressive issues. And one of the issues where they came around together was on this issue of free tuition at public colleges and universities. And so, you know, there were some changes from what he was originally proposing, but essentially they merged their two college proposals and brought the best of both together. So,
and listeners, if you want to call in and talk to Bernie Sanders campaign manager from 2016, Jeff Weaver, or folks here in the green space, if you want to raise your hand, we'll come around with a microphone on the phones, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I know everybody wants to know if he's going to run for president in 2020, but let's stay on 2018 for a second.
Sure, of course.
There was a primary election last week in which there was a Bernie Sanders-backed candidate versus an Elizabeth Warren-backed candidate. Is the party or the progressive movement that fractured?
Maybe it's that dominant that we actually have a primary contest between the people in the progressive wing. That may be the answer to that.
Is that going to be something do you think that situation was unique, or are we going to be seeing more of that as the, especially primary season goes on?
Right. Well, Bernie actually didn't endorse in that race. Our Revolution, which was the organization that spun out of his presidential campaign, did endorse Dennis Kucinich. Look, there are a lot of people running all across the country. There are a number of races, certainly for Congress, where you have a number of progressives running against each other. And, you know, my feeling now is my feeling in 2016, which is let the voters decide who the nominees are. That's really what we should do.
Has Bernie been going around the country a lot?
Yes, he has been. So he has been doing really three things since the disappointing election of Donald Trump. One is he has tried to keep the grassroots energized and hopeful. You know, he did a series of rallies around the country when the president was trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. He did a number of rallies around the country against the disastrous Republican tax bill. So that was one element of it. He has been raising money for down-ballot Democrats. In fact, over the last 2 years, he's raised, I think, over $6 million for down-ballot Democrats across the country. And number three is he's actually been out campaigning for Democrats around the country. He was just in Pennsylvania. John Fetterman's running for lieutenant governor there. Rich Lazor is in one of the congressional districts. Greg Edwards, another one. Jess King, another one. So he was just in Pennsylvania. He's been in the upper Midwest. He's been in the Southwest. He was down in the South. So he has been actively campaigning for candidates across the country.
You believe, obviously, that Bernie Sanders or someone like him is more positioned to bring back Trump voters than a more centrist Democrat. And again, we'll get to 2020. But here in 2018, the issue is control of Congress.
Sure.
And David Leonhardt has a New York Times column today that says, I'm paraphrasing, but it's really district by district, and the progressive purists should realize that. Fair enough?
No, look, I do think it's district by district. And I think, you know, I think what's of concern to there are obviously overarching themes that affect everyone, jobs, healthcare, education, issues of equality. But there are, you know, local issues that affect different communities differently. And I think that there has to be some room for candidates to do that. But at the end of the day, the question is who does that candidate stand with? Is it working people, middle-income people they're going to stand with, or are they going to stand with corporate interests? So, you know, the modern history of the Democratic Party really took off with FDR, and he clearly was on the side of working people and middle-income people. You know, it was, when we think about the debates we have now and lack of civility, you know, if you look back at some of the things that were lodged against FDR, it's incredible. And, you know, the Democratic Party got off track in the 90s with this neoliberal experiment. And, you know, 2016 in its historical context was really the grassroots of the party trying to retake the party and put it back on its historical trajectory.
And so for president, if Sanders versus Clinton was what you just described, the progressive wing versus the more centrist or neoliberal wing, is that even relevant for 2020? Are there any centrist neoliberal Democrats left who will be running for president?
Well, I mean, as I say in the book, I think that the grassroots has repudiated the neoliberals. But, you know, they still hold sway within certain organs of the party, certainly among the donor party donor class. They have representation. There are certainly corporate interests that have circled around the party for the last 20 years who certainly would like to reassert themselves. It's just not a strategy for winning.
Right? We have at least five people in our tri-state area being mentioned as possible presidential hopefuls. Obviously, you have your loyalty to Bernie, but how would you handicap any of these people? From New York, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Governor Andrew Cuomo, Mayor Bill de Blasio. From New Jersey, Senator Cory Booker. And from Connecticut, Senator Chris Murphy, potentially. Who would you be most afraid of on behalf of Bernie Sanders?
Now, this is a very provocative question. Look, one of the things that's always amazing to me is if you look at the people who are being talked about as presidential contenders on the Democratic side for 2020, the incredible pool of talent that you have there, as opposed to what we saw in 2016 on the Republican side, when, you know, it's been variously described as a clown car or what have you, but it was, you know, there was just a real sort of dearth of talent and insight. So I think the Democratic Party is in a great place for 2020, frankly. I just think there's a lot of great candidates out there.
Can you make the case today that Sanders is a better candidate for the general election than Senator Gillibrand?
Yeah, look, what we found across the country in 2016 is that Bernie Sanders was able to bring together what are the groups who have, you know, maintained support for the Democratic Party, but he was also able to reach out to voters who were previously part of what I call the FDR coalition, who have since left as a result of what happened in the 1990s. And you'd see that he actually did better with rural Democrats, with more conservative, quote unquote, more conservative Democrats among, you know, rank and file voters. So I think he has the opportunity to put together a coalition that nobody else who could run could put together.
Is Bernie Sanders a Democrat? Are you? And does it matter?
I am a Democrat. Bernie Sanders is a member of the Democratic leadership. I'm going to give you the circuitous answer. A member of the Democratic leadership in the Senate. He has raised millions of dollars for down ballot Democrats. He was a superdelegate to the Democratic National Convention. He was strong, obviously, advocate for Hillary Clinton's election in the general election in 2016. If you go to the Vermont Democratic Party website of their elected officials, you'll see him there. He is the Democratic Party endorsed candidate in Vermont. So, you know, we don't have party registration in Vermont. Nobody carries a little card in their wallet that says D or R, and that's true in, you know, in many, many states. And so, you know, what does it mean to be a Democrat? I think he is a leader in the Democratic Party.
It's one of the issues that's relevant to how the primaries are run in a lot of states where people could not vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary because he was an independent. You obviously want to see that change, but the argument on the other side is, well, wait, it's a party with members, and so they should have their primary, and that's the way things should work.
Right, but look, if say you live in New York, right, and you donate to the Democratic Party, you work on behalf of Democratic candidates, in the general election, you're a reliable Democratic voter. If you have a little card, you get to vote in the primary. If you don't have a little card, you don't get to vote in the primary. If you go to Vermont or Virginia or a lot of other places, if you're a similarly situated person, you don't have a little card because they don't have little cards, you get to vote in the primary. And so voters in different places are treated very differently. And what one of the problems that we're having is that young people overwhelmingly now are registering as independents or no party affiliation, and you're shutting out a whole new generation of voters whose relationship to institutions, not just political parties, but to religion and companies and everything else, is very different than the way we think about our relationships to those institutions. And if you want to have a party that's going to be increasingly older and smaller, I think the closed primaries is the way to go.
My guest is Jeff Weaver, who was the 2016 campaign manager for Bernie Sanders. He has a new book called How Bernie Won: Inside the Revolution That's Taking Back Our Country and Where We Go From Here. And let's take a question from here in the green space. Ma'am, hi.
Hello, I'm Jackie Hawken from Bristol in the UK. And one of the other things he's been doing is traveling abroad, because he came to Bristol, to my city, and was received with tumultuous applause, actually. We really love him. What's interesting is that Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn are both white, socialist-leaning, older men who appeal very much to the younger voters. Why do you think that is?
Look, in our increasingly virtual world, I think people are looking for authenticity in their political leaders. And I think both Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn are viewed as people who at least tell it the way they see it, right? And I think voters respond to that, certainly here in the U.S. I mean, you know, people remember George W. Bush. You know, when you'd poll the issues, the positions he took and stood for, people disagreed with him, right, across the board. But when you said, who are you going to vote for president? Oh, I'm going to vote for George W. Bush because, you know, he's a straight shooter and he tells it the way it is and I don't agree. But and I think people really appreciate the fact that you have people who are sort of unabashed in their pronouncements.
We have another question in the green space over here. Hi.
Yes. In reference to Bernie running for president, everybody, he's running. There are a couple of issues.
Who's the campaign manager?
Here? I don't know. I'm happy to go back to my comic book store, Frank.
Okay. Your cover story. Two things that Cory Booker and I think some others is this idea of every job for everybody. Everybody has a job, you know, which pays the minimum wage, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the other issue, which I don't hear discussed, and that's the guaranteed minimum income, because robots are going to be taking over. If you can get a $20,000 robot doll, then you can get a doll that'll prepare hamburgers and put people out of work. And that doll for $20,000 is going to replace five people. Anyway, could you compare those to the guaranteed annual income? I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yep.
And the other, a job for everybody, because the job for everybody doesn't seem so good to me.
First of all, you should be in broadcasting, because that was a great segue from our last segment
with the
robot doll.
Tying it all together.
And you know, Jeff, we've had three authors in recent times, Chris Hughes, who was a Facebook founder, and Andy Stern, who, as you know, is the head of SEIU for a long time, and there was a third one, all calling for a guaranteed national income for exactly the reason the gentleman says, automation. They had their different reasons, but primarily automation is going to replace so many jobs. Is that a position that Bernie Sanders is willing to adopt, and do you think that position has any future in mainstream politics?
So I'll answer the second part first. I certainly think that that's an issue that we are going to have to confront, right? It is always the case that sort of the people who have the money who are going to set up the factories and so on and so forth are always looking for the cheapest way to make anything. You know, starting in the 90s, you know, they started shipping jobs overseas because they could get cheaper labor there. If they think it's going to be cheaper to use automation, they're going to be doing, you know, they'll do that too. But that's the responsibility of policymakers to make sure that doesn't, you know, destroy the economic lives of working men and women in this country, which is something that we have not been willing to confront. Bernie Sanders is actually working on a bill, it was reported in the news, working on a bill about guaranteed employment for people who want it at a $15 minimum wage. You know, these are not, I wouldn't call them competing, but they're different ways of getting at the same problem, which is how do you make sure that the economy works for everybody
in
this country?
You're not there yet. And you're hoping you don't have to get there.
No, these are issues we're going to have to confront as a society. You know, how do we share the resources that, frankly, are generated by a company, but, you know, the company benefits from the fact that their trucks are using the road and that the military is protecting their installations and the police disproportionately protect them, and just because they have so much more than everybody else does. And, you know, I think we have to understand the social context in which profits are made and how those profits are distributed.
Let's take another question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi. Bernie, at an appearance with Elizabeth Warren, made a statement that Trump voters are not racist, they're not sexist, they're not generally bigots. Sitting at the butt end of their hatred, they actually are. And I found those statements incredibly offensive from Bernie. Has he reconsidered those thoughts at all?
Well, I think, you know, I was very interested after the election. You know, Van Jones, who was a very thoughtful CNN person, you know, had some thoughts about on this front. And, you know, is there racism in this country? Absolutely. Is it systematized in many ways? Absolutely. Is it personal to many people? Absolutely. Does it need to be ferreted out in every place it exists? Absolutely. But, you know, what you have to reconcile and wrestle with is when you look at people who voted for President Obama twice and then voted for Trump, you have to reconcile whether those people's primary political motivation is racial animus.
Not a lot of people in that category, right?
No, there are a lot of people in that category. You know, there's one county, one media market in Pennsylvania, Scranton Media Market. It's 10% of the state. And it represents 40, it's a quote-unquote white working class part of Pennsylvania. That 10% represents 40% of the switch from Obama to Trump. So how do you reconcile that those people are primarily motivated by racial animus? Right. I'm not saying there aren't people who vote for Trump who are motivated by racial animus, because there certainly are.
But it's pockets. And let me follow up on the gentleman's question like this. Trump is, I've said this before, I'm just going to say it, a practicing racist.
Absolutely.
In the respect that he consciously uses racist appeals and nativist appeals to energize his base. That means that there is a large enough core of people out there for whom it resonates when he does those things, that it should be very troubling to other Americans and be denounced by someone like Bernie Sanders.
Who denounces it constantly about Trump's nativism, in the population, his xenophobia.
As well as by Trump.
Oh, no, absolutely. Look, there's no room for that in America. There just is no room for that. And he has been very vocal about that. You know, he was in the South recently, meeting with a new generation of black leaders. And there really is, it can't be strong enough, the denunciation of it.
Is it strong enough by him based
on? It can never be strong enough. That's the problem, right? I mean, you've just seen it. You know, we have Louisiana. We have a young black man they've ruled it a homicide. You know, his killing at the hands of police. I mean, this just continues and continues and continues. And so when you say, is it strong enough? It can never be strong enough.
But just to finish the thread on the listener, the audience member's question, if Bernie Sanders said that, well, those voters, Trump's voters aren't racist, is that too simplistic?
Yeah, it is.
Too generous. To too many people.
Are there people who voted for Trump who are racist and who have racial animus? Yes. Is everybody who voted for Trump a racist or primarily motivated by racial animus? I think the answer to that is obviously no.
Let's take a phone call online to Keith in Edison. You're on WNYC with Jeff Weaver, Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign manager. Hi, Keith. Do we have Keith online too? Can we give that a shot?
Yes, hello? Can you hear me?
Now you're on. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I did have a question. It's kind of a controversial one, but I just wanted to get a bit more understanding about how Bernie Sanders, you said earlier that the primary was won by Hillary Clinton, but then facts kind of pop up later on showing how Hillary kind of rigged that DNC to basically take the rug out from underneath him. And I'm wondering as to why that isn't really spoken about as much.
And in the book, you don't hold back in your criticism of the DNC's favoritism toward Hillary. What do you want to say about it now?
I mean, no, I don't hold back about it. And other people have written about it as well. Donna Brazil, you know, who's a former DNC chair, wrote about it. Others have written about it. Look, the system was... you know, Hillary Clinton was running basically unopposed. The party came in behind her. Bernie announced at the end of April in 2015. He was at 3% in the polls. But as he gained steam over the summer, what is called the media dubbed the summer of Sanders, you know, the Democratic Party circled around Secretary Clinton. And, you know, whether it's the debate schedule, the joint fundraising agreements, the way the caucuses were held in some places, you know, there were a lot of things done that I think an honest person standing back and looking at it objectively would say, that's not really even-handed. And, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the chair at the time, was certainly orchestrating much of this.
You learned some of these damning things about the DNC from the emails that were presumably stolen by Russia.
Right.
Did it ever occur to you to refuse to use them against the Democratic Party because they were the product of Russian hacking, maybe even in collusion with the Trump campaign?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that I'm using them against the Democratic Party. So, you know, there were many people on the executive committee of the Democratic National Party who were at various times trying to keep Debbie Wasserman Schultz from putting her finger on the scale. So it is not the Democratic Party writ large, first of all. And two, look, what came out in those emails... they were clearly ill-gotten gains. But there are things in there which have not been refuted and which, you know, based on what I know, are not refutable. And people need to know what happened if that information is available.
So you're less critical of Russian meddling than some other Democrats might be?
No,
because they reveal things?
Nice segue. No, I am not less I am not less critical of Russian meddling. Absolutely not. Look, and I'll say this about Hillary Clinton. No candidate should have to run against the Foreign Intelligence Service of another country. Hillary Clinton should not have had to run against the Russian Intelligence Service, which she clearly had to do. That being said, I also think in foreign countries, they should not have to run against our intelligence service, frankly.
Last question then. Just give people from your vantage point of, you know, knowing so much about how politics works, a viewer's guide, a campaign manager's eye guide to the 2018 election year. What are the big things that you think people should be looking at, either in what's left of the primary season or as we head toward the general?
Right. Well, you've seen some polls that have shown this sort of margin between Democrats and Republicans closing just a bit. And I think you'll see those go up and down as we get closer and closer. But, you know, what I have seen out there, and this has been in all the races since Trump was elected, whether it has been a Democratic victory or a Republican victory, is that the Republican has grossly underperformed where Trump was. I mean, in Montana, the Democratic candidate for Congress there, even though he lost, you know, did 20% better than Hillary Clinton had done in Montana, right? So the margin is closing everywhere. The level of excitement and enthusiasm among Democratic voters is super high. And so, you know, the burden is going to be on us in the Democratic Party to keep that enthusiasm up, to present candidates who have bold visions, who are able to excite voters. And these are, you know, the voters who vote less consistently. These are the people who typically don't come out in midterms and allow Republicans to win. We've got to make sure those voters come out.
Based on giving people an alternative vision of policy, not just running against Trump and his character?
Absolutely. If anybody's not convinced about Trump's character by now, you're not going to convince them. And I think the Clinton campaign has been criticized to some degree that they overfocused on Trump's personal flaws or financial misdeeds, and not enough on an alternative policy vision. I mean, if you look, and you can go online and look at this, both campaigns had a 2-minute ad at the end of the campaign, which ran in battleground states. Trump's ad is focused almost exclusively on jobs, the economy, trade, helping people out. Hillary's was a much more sort of personal ad about her personal values. And I just think as a political professional, whatever that means, that his ad was a much more effective communication to the voters.
The book is called How Bernie Won. The author is Jeff Weaver, the 2016 campaign manager and still senior advisor to Bernie Sanders. Please thank Jeff Weaver, excuse me, for coming to the Green Space. And coming up next, we continue our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. We are in 1968, right after this.